Well, a few weeks ago when I was at the X conference in Washington, D.C., Graham Hancock came up to me and introduced himself. He's been on the program before, but we had never met. Well, he's here now on Coast to Coast AM, and he's next. Graham Hancock has become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises legitimate questions about humanity's history and prehistory and offers an increasingly popular challenge to the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars. Graduating from Durham University, first-class honors in sociology, he then went on to pursue a career in quality journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. Here he is, full program tonight with Graham Hancock on Coast to Coast AM. Graham, how are you?
I'm fine, George. How are you?
Likewise. It was great meeting you out there.
It was great. And what a wonderful event that was. Yes, it was fantastic to meet you. And I thought a lot of really intriguing ideas were aired at that conference.
Does it add to the program and to the interview when you know face-to-face who's interviewing you?
I just wanted
to ask somebody.
Yeah, it definitely does. When we've talked a few times on the phone, and you get to know the other person on the phone, but there's nothing like that face-to-face contact and actually meeting the person and seeing how that person is to really cement that connection, I think.
So true. Yeah. And it makes, I think, a more well-rounded conversation, too.
It does. I mean, this is one of the great things about your show, that it has the feel, of a couple of old friends who are getting together to discuss important matters. And there's that kind of warmth and connection to it that actually, to be honest, you don't find on that many other shows.
Later on, you can give us updates on Fingerprints of the Gods, but you've got a new work out called Supernatural. Tell me a little bit about this, and how did we get into that?
Well, it was a strange process for me because, as you know, and perhaps some of your listeners know, over the last 15 years, I've been focusing on the possibility that there could have been a lost civilization, that there's a great untold story in our history and prehistory, and I've looked very much at the last sort of 10 or 12,000 years in that perspective, and really having finished with Fingerprints of the Gods and Underworld, where I took that quest underwater and spent 5 years scuba diving all around the world, I felt that I had reached the point where I wanted to venture into something a bit new, a bit different. And I really thought what I would do is go back and look at the mystery of human origins, go back much further, perhaps even millions of years. And this was the genesis of my book, Supernatural. But like all books, when you really start to wrestle with them and get to grips with them, you find yourself steered by the book itself in a direction that you did not expect to go. And that's what happened to me with Supernatural. I found myself steered in a complete... I thought I was going to be writing about, the missing link and more of a mainstream story of human evolution. But I found myself instead confronted by an extraordinary mystery and by a period of human prehistory which is truly strange and eerie. I mean, to cut a long story short, what I found is that most of the story of human evolution, certainly as it's accepted by mainstream scholars, is incredibly dull. In fact, I call it 6 million years of boredom, really, from the last common ancestor with a chimpanzee about 6 million years ago, through to anatomically modern humans slightly less than 200,000 years ago. And the boring behavior, the non-innovative thinking, the evidence that our ancestors could not think laterally or creatively, had no sense of the abstract. Weirdly, this continues even after they become anatomically modern, even after they look just like you and me, with the same brain size as we do, their behavior carries on being, I think the word really is uninnovative. There is just no innovation. They get locked into rigid patterns of behavior and they never, never change it. And then really quite suddenly all over the world, somewhere shortly after 40,000 years ago, something really extraordinary happens to our ancestors everywhere. It's like a huge wave of enlightenment just sweeps across them. And in an instant, they become recognizable through their behavior, the traces of which they have left in the archaeological record. They become recognizable as us, we realize that we're dealing not with basically, ape men who happen to look like us, but actually us with the same sensitivities, the same feelings. It's all suddenly there at once, fully formed, as though somebody has turned on a light switch. And the greatest evidence for this really comes from two things. Suddenly, our ancestors start burying their dead, and they do so in a reverential way, and they bury with them items of food and water. This has never happened before. And what it tells us is that they have got to grips, they've grappled with the concept that some part of the individual survives physical death, that we are more than our physical selves, that something goes on. That concept is very, very clearly evident in their burials. And the second thing that happens exactly the same time, and it's difficult to say, you know, which is cause or which is effect, or whether they're both effects of some other cause, is that they start creating the most majestic and extraordinary art. Art which Picasso, when he first visited it at the Cave of Lascaux in France, he came out and admitted frankly to reporters, we have invented nothing. Those ancient artists knew everything that we knew, and they thought in abstract ways and created the most extraordinary images that are truly eerie. When you go into these underground caves in southern France and Spain and other parts of Europe, which go back, in some cases, 35,000 years, you find yourself in vast, echoing cathedrals of the spirit, which are decorated and painted in the most eerie and touching and poignant manner. Great beauty is unveiled before you, and they've used the rock face, and you almost get a sense that they're telling you that on the other side of the rock face is another world, inhabited by strange beings who sometimes appear in part animal and part human form. And sometimes, and we'll get into this, there are a number of examples of this, appear in a form that any of us today, familiar with the popular media, would recognize as a gray, as what we think of as the typical alien. There are a number of images, more than 25,000 years old, in the caves, which show that kind of figure very, very clearly and very distinctly. So this is all very weird. And at the same time, our ancestors' economic behavior starts to become much more sophisticated. Their hunting strategies are radically, radically overhauled. They become incredibly efficient and cunning. Their weapons and tools take a quantum leap forward. So something has happened to them, and this is why the subtitle of my book, the title is Supernatural, the subtitle is Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind, because I cannot resist the conclusion that some encounter happened to our ancestors at that point that switched us on, that put us on a new track. And that's what I ended up focusing on, and that's what I ended up investigating, is what was it? What was that extraordinary moment in human history that made us fully human for the first time?
Your work somewhat similar to Michael Cremo's, or one could say Michael Cremo's work somewhat similar to yours, Chris.
Well, I would say that they're complementary in a way. Michael goes down some tracks that I don't go down. Michael has presented a huge amount of evidence for which I know Michael personally. He's a wonderful man, a fantastic researcher. Really has done the most incredible work, which I would recommend to everyone. And he has documented quite a few strange and mysterious exceptions to the accepted evolutionary story, and suggested that actually anatomically modern humans may have been present on the planet much earlier, millions of years ago, not hundreds of thousands of years ago. Now, I don't go there in my book. Over the years, I've been obliged to spend so much of my time fighting with mainstream academics that about my own view of history, my own take on the possibility of a lost civilization, I found that I And it almost seems like a strategy on their part that I end up getting bogged down in these arguments with orthodox academics.
That's so, how they contain you, Graham.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's how they contain us all, is that they pick some little quibble or niggle with your argument and then try to expand it out into something which can, you know, which they claim destroys the whole argument. And so instead of actually, you see, I see my role as advancing ideas that perhaps other people aren't advancing. I think the whole area of inquiry into what it is to be human is an open area. I don't think it belongs to a particular group of people like academics. And I think there is a role for making counter suggestions, for saying that, hang on, guys, things may not be quite the way they are, and what or the way they seem. And what I discovered was that this leads to a furious reaction, as though you've disturbed a hornet's nest amongst the tight-knit academic community who claim to be the sole representatives and interpreters of human history to us, and that they then swarm upon you in fury from all over the world and attack you in every underhand way that they possibly can. So I ended up for quite a while, rather than really advancing new ideas, which I wanted to do, fighting with these incredibly boring guys, and they mainly are guys, you know. And so it becomes a sort of male ego fest, which I really detested. So I actually made a decision in this book, in Supernatural, that I was going to focus on an area that even the mainstream academics agree is truly weird, and that there are very, very strange things about it. And I was then going to go into that area in ways that they themselves did not necessarily go. And so in Supernatural, I don't look at the possibility that there might be 2 million-year-old anatomically human beings, anatomically modern human beings on the planet. I don't look, as Michael does, at the evidence that there might have been even high technologies in that period. What I look at is an accepted a mystery, that there's this extraordinary moment in human prehistory, and no academic will deny it, when a light is switched on, and our ancestors transform their behavior almost literally overnight. And what could have led to that? And I found that there is, even in mainstream academia, there is a growing awareness that there was something very, very odd about this. And I found the work of Professor David Lewis Williams, who's professor of archaeology at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, for 20 years, really from the mid-80s through until past the year 2000, he conscientiously and vigorously advocated an alternative point of view as to what it was that switched our ancestors on 40-odd thousand years ago. And gradually, because his arguments are so thorough and his field research is so beautifully documented, more and more of the mainstream academic community came round to his point of view. And this point of view, which is central to my argument in Supernatural, I would say now is almost universally accepted by mainstream academics. What they don't accept are the onward implications of that point of view. And to cut a long story short, that point of view is that our ancestors created these extraordinary cave paintings and manifested this amazing quantum leap forward in their overall behavior as beings because they had experienced altered states of consciousness, that they had encountered psychedelic plants, and that they had begun to use these systematically, their shamans had begun to use them systematically to enter alternative states of consciousness, and that in those states of consciousness they experienced visions and encounters with entities and beings, which they then, when they returned to a normal state of consciousness, depicted. The earliest documents of human history, they depicted on the walls mm-hmm. of the painted caves, and thus they document their encounters with their beings. Now, this is where thus far and no further do I go with the mainstream academics, because they then stop and say, oh, well, of course the art was majestic, and of course there was a fantastic leap forward in human behavior, but they were just having hallucinations, and there's no real fundamental meaning to this. And where I ended up taking this, because the evidence drove me there, is that these experiences that we call hallucinations in our culture, and that the shamans of hunter-gatherer societies still surviving all around the world call visions, that these visions are not unreal, that they are a retuning of the receiver wavelength of the human brain to allow us to see other realities that surround us and interpenetrate us at all times, but which in a normal, alert, problem-solving state of consciousness, we cannot normally access. And in a way, this is a criticism that I have of mainstream science in general, which is that it's very state-specific. Everything that our science does is predicated on the notion that one particular state of human consciousness, the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness that we find useful to function in business and the military and commerce in the modern world, that this is really the only state of consciousness and that there are no other valid states of consciousness. Right. And thus our science refuses to investigate other states of consciousness. In fact, perversely, or perhaps not perversely,
it is very narrow, isn't it?
It's extremely narrow, and actually not only do they not investigate the vast range of human consciousness, not only do they not investigate it, but they've actually, in collaboration with governments, made it pretty much illegal to investigate it. There you may not go, they say. And actually they send you to prison if you do go there. So it becomes very difficult to investigate this. So we have this incredible creature ourselves with a vast range of consciousness, really, truly, truly immense. And we have decided that we are really only interested in a tiny, narrow sliver of that vast range of potential, and that we will focus only on that, and that all our experimental methods and all our so-called scientific approach will be based on the notion that that is the only valid form of human consciousness. And as a result, we rule out almost the entire range of human potential in our investigations. So no wonder, in my opinion, modern science, while achieving great things in the narrow material band, is so screwed up and leads us to so many problems.
Graham, why do we need the mood-altering substances in order to reach that state of consciousness? Why can't we do it without it?
Some of us don't need the mood-altering substances or the consciousness-altering substances, but many of us do. There's a Puritan streak in our society which regards, taking anything, any substance, any plant to change our consciousness as fundamentally wrong. But I think we have to accept that that streak is rooted in a particular history and a story of history that we have had, and that it may not be valid. After all, our brains are bioelectrochemical devices. Everything that we experience is experienced through the chemistry of our brains. I mean, go try and have an experience without any neurotransmitters. I guarantee you won't have any. So we can't object in principle to the notion that chemicals and substances are fundamental to how we experience reality. It's just illogical to object to that when we actually look at brain chemistry. Chemicals are fundamental to our experience of reality, and therefore we should hesitate before we automatically, robotically, like automata, accept the Puritan notions that have been stuffed down our throats from the 17th century. We should hesitate before we fully accept those and consider the possibilities that, since all our experiences are mediated by neurochemicals, it may be interested to explore the range of experiences by altering the neurochemical balance of the brain, specifically and deliberately, as shamans have done for tens of thousands of years, using plants that have co-evolved with us on this planet. I think we need to rid ourselves of that knee-jerk puritanical reaction, which frankly is not thought through and is not based on any logic. And here's the thing. We are physical beings for sure. My own personal belief is that we are spiritual beings in essence, immersed in a physical form, rather as a man wears a suit. In order to live and survive and thrive in the physical world, we have to be connected to that physical world. It's very important that we understand the laws of physics in this physical realm, and that we function. And in fact, our day-to-day survival depends on us being able to function in this physical realm. But the fact that being the case, it leads us to exclude all other kinds of consciousness.
Let's pick it up from there, Graham, when we come right back. Graham Hancock, our special guest tonight. Wow, we'll be back. Well, if you're thinking of something novel as a gift, you might want to consider the After Dark magazine. It's a great magazine, full color. Go to coasttocoastam.com to subscribe or call 1-888-727-5505. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Graham Hancock, our special guest tonight. Graham, you also talk in Supernatural about the case of spirits and aliens and fairies, that they could all be one and the same. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, this is coming to the same thing. In fact, if I could just pick you up for a moment,
sure.
on what we were saying.
I'm a little heavy.
At the end, me
180.
Too. At the end of the last segment, we were talking about altered states of consciousness and substances, and I was making the case that as physical beings with a spiritual essence, all our experiences of the world and of reality are mediated through our brains, and brains have chemistry, and it's impossible to have experiences without neurochemistry. So we can't, in principle, object to the notion that experiences that can perhaps be enhanced, or that it's possible to peer into different areas of reality by altering our brain chemistry, by changing the receiver wavelength of the brain. And some people, and scientific evidence is that it's around about 2% of every human population, have the ability to do this absolutely spontaneously. They can alter their state of consciousness, sometimes at will, and sometimes it just happens to them without them knowing why they're doing it. And the intriguing thing is that a brain chemical, which is also a Schedule 1 hallucinogen, is implicated in this. And that brain chemical is DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which all of us have in our bodies, even though it is a Schedule 1 drug, the consumption of which can send us to jail for many years. It's actually produced in the pineal gland. In the brain. And the suggestion is that spontaneous visionaries are people who automatically, without taking any substance, overproduce. Their pineal gland goes into a period of hyperactivity. They overproduce dimethyltryptamine, and they enter into a DMT trance and have experiences in those trance. And then we come back to the standard scientific model, which says that all such experiences must inevitably be unreal, because they are not experienced in the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness that our society so sickeningly admires above all other states of consciousness. And yet, the fact that our brains produce this chemical, dimethyltryptamine, and have done so for a very long time, tells us that it must have some function or some part in mm-hmm. our lives. And therefore, what would be the objection in principle, since we understand that it's a natural product of the human brain, what would be the objection in principle to increasing the amount deliberately, intently, with intention, in order to see what experiences we have?
Maybe they don't want us to see this.
Well, I believe absolutely, George, that they don't want us to see. And I think that the whole very cleverly structured so-called war on drugs, which is financed with billions and billions of dollars of our own money, probably came about because of those CIA and other secret agency mind control experiments that were done in the 60s, the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, often with volunteers who didn't even know what was being done to them, who were given high-powered hallucinogens. I suspect that our masters in this society of ours learned something during those experiments that told them that if everybody had these experiences, which was becoming possible in the climate of the 60s, if everybody had these experiences, then their grip on our hearts and minds might be broken forever.
It
and I think
gone.
That it would be blown away. And I think the decision was taken very deliberately then to engage in a massive mind control exercise, which was intended to stop the average citizen from ever being able to have such experiences, which might shake their view of the whole nature of reality and and pluck away their loyalty from the military-industrial state, which is what our societies basically are today. So actually, yes, I do think there is a conspiracy here. I think the CIA and other agencies learned something back in the 50s, 60s, through to the early 70s when they were doing these experiments. And I think I think it scared them. And they decided that there would be, that their grip on society would be fatally weakened if they allowed this to proceed. And the whole war on drugs, I think, comes from that. I think it's filled with lies and propaganda and misinformation, but it has become so rooted into people's patterns of thought and indeed so rooted into the language itself, such that we cannot use the word drug without coupling it with the word abuse. The notion that there might be responsible, adult, mature use of drugs is ruled out by the very notion of drug abuse, which is always connected to the word drug. And this is rather like Orwellian language in 1984, where the language itself is turned against the citizen so that it becomes impossible for the citizen to think independently because the language is being constructed by the powers that be. So I do think that there is a huge issue underlying this, which is the issue of individual freedom and individual liberty. And it always saddens and faintly horrifies me that good Republican Americans, for the most part, Republicans, I have Democrats too, but let's talk about the Republicans, who passionately believe in the freedom of the individual adult and who believe in adult responsibility, indeed who believe in it so much that they militantly feel it is the right of every adult to own a gun, because they rightly point out that it is not the gun which is the evil thing, but it's the misuse of the gun by certain individuals, and therefore responsible individuals should not be denied the right to bear weapons. Indeed, it's protected in the American Constitution. The very same individuals who think that are also the people who most vigorously persecute drug users. Now, let's just pause and think about what is involved with, for example, the use of hallucinogens like dimethyltryptamine and LSD. This concerns the consciousness of the individual. If you consider what is a human being, what is the most important, the most significant part of the human being, certainly not his arms and legs or his stomach or her stomach, his or her, it is the consciousness of the individual. It is our consciousness that makes us human.
It's the soul of that person.
It's the soul of that person, and yet we live in a society which tells us that it is illegal, that we are evil, depraved individuals, that we must be sent to prison, sometimes for up to 30 years, if we as adults, responsibly, in the privacy of our own homes, doing no harm to others, choose to explore our own consciousness. And I think it's a Republican duty, frankly, if the Republican Party genuinely believes in the freedom of the individual, then they must protect the individual's freedom of consciousness. I'm not saying freedom of conscience, although they must protect that as well. I'm saying freedom of consciousness. And therefore, to be a true Republican, I believe it is necessary for Republicans to advocate and defend the right of adults responsibly to explore their own consciousness with plants and substances that have co-evolved with us on this planet for millions of years. And it creates an extraordinary contradiction if the Republican Party does not do that, and yet it doesn't do that because there's this knee-jerk puritanism coupled with the misinformation of the war on drugs. Now, of course, there may be a downside. There may be damage. There is, of course, a damage to guns. Many people get killed every year by guns, but the fundamental principle that responsible adults should not be restricted in that area by the state, and that they should only be punished if they then behave irresponsibly, that should also apply to consciousness-altering substances. The adult choice to explore one's own consciousness with drugs is a choice that adults should be allowed to make in a free society. Now, if those adults then go and get in someone else's face and cause that person trouble, then the state should intervene, but not before. That's my view.
In your opinion, Graham, by getting into this altered state, what does it do to the individual? What kind of information are they going to obtain?
Most often, it does healthy and positive things. Now, I'm not speaking about addictive drugs like heroin. My own view is that all drugs should be legal. I think that
I've said that too, just to get the crime rate under control.
To get the crime rate first and foremost, if we want to get crime down, we've got to stop this unholy alliance between criminal gangs and our government, which has been engendered by the whole war on drugs. Half the crime in our society is caused by this problem, and it would go away overnight if government would simply legalize these substances and control and regulate them in the same way that we do with alcohol.
Yes.
We've had the experience. We saw it in prohibition in the United States back at the early part of the 20th century. It just doesn't work. It causes crime. Are we brain dead? Don't we realize that? It causes crime. And the war on drugs is causing half the crime in our society. The answer is not more and more draconian penalties, not more and more billions of dollars given to armed state agencies to invade the privacy of our own consciousness. The answer is to make all these substances legal and to regulate them and control them. Overnight, you would get rid of all the drug gangs. We would have no more drug crime. Overnight, you would get rid of the dangers of badly cut and prepared street drugs, which cause so many deaths. You would have quality. I do not think you would see a vast increase in drug taking. Most people would still choose not to do it.
Yep.
But those who do it would no longer, for exploring their own consciousness responsibly as adults, would no longer face these heinous prison sentences.
And look what you do to the cartels.
And you destroy the cartels overnight. They're suddenly without a market. They have no market at all because, of course, regulated and controlled through government, these substances can be made available at a price that will... It's simpler economics. They'll undercut the cartels. They'll have higher quality and lower price. Overnight, the cartels are out of business. They can't do that anymore. And there's no more drug wars. Everything, all that horrible miasma of awful human behavior where we are willingly handing over our young people to the worst people on the planet would be gone. And instead, hopefully, wise advice through our society, friendly advice, not advice backed up by vicious draconian punishments, but friendly advice that we understand and accept would be available to us. And the classic example of this, I realize we're getting far from our topic.
Yeah, let's come back real soon.
We'll come back to it. But the classic example is tobacco. Look at the vast fall in the consumption of tobacco over the last 20 years. That's happened because people have been given good, honest information about tobacco, which they have believed, and they've made the rational decision as adults to stop smoking cigarettes. That's what we need to do with drugs. If drugs are truly harmful, let's give them the information and let's trust adults to realize that the way they've done that with tobacco. Tobacco was never illegal. Smoking cigarettes was never punished by 30 years in prison. And yet the consumption of tobacco has fallen. On the other hand, the consumption of all hard drugs has vastly increased in the last 40 years. Therefore, any logical person can see that the present policy isn't working and we need a change of direction. And philosophically, if we respect the integrity and the sovereignty of the adult, then we have to respect the adult's right to explore his or her own consciousness. Because if I'm not sovereign over my own consciousness, then I'm not sovereign over anything. And it's a waste of time to talk about freedom. It's a total waste of time to talk about it. So there's my rant over, George. Let's get back to the subject.
And what is there in the consciousness that they want us to hide?
I think that they want us focused on a very narrow strip of reality, which relates to production and consumption, to turn us into robotic machines in the prevailing state system, which they so highly value. And yet, when we look at the ruin of the world around us today, it's all caused by people who are absolutely focused on that state, on the alert problem-solving state of consciousness and no other state of consciousness. I think there are vast realms of experience out there. Here's where we interface with quantum physics. Here's where we interface with the notion of parallel dimensions. And honestly, if I were to put money on it, I would bet that the UFO abduction phenomenon and its connection, because you raised this a moment ago, with fairies and with spirits that shamans encounter, all of this is about the possible range of human experience. And most of us, most of the time, don't encounter so-called aliens or spirits or fairies because our consciousness is narrowly focused into the alert problem-solving mentality. But if we allow our consciousness to expand, if we consider the brain itself as an instrument with which we study reality, you know, we're used to the idea of telescopes and microscopes. We will increase our ability to peer into the minuscule realm with microscopes, and we'll increase our ability to peer into the vast distances of space with telescopes. And we're quite used to enhancing our senses with mechanical devices. But what people have not thought through yet is that there may be an extraordinary way to enhance our senses by adjusting the receiver wavelength of the brain. And that, in my view, is what happens in altered states of consciousness. So the experiences we have in those states of consciousness are not illusions and you know, your brain on drugs. What those experiences actually are like applying a lens to the brain and allowing us to see more of reality than we normally see. And I think the powers that be don't want us to see more of reality in that way.
You've talked about the ancients depicting, let's say, these aliens, and they all seem very similar, which tells me then they're all experiencing the same thing. They're all seeing the same creatures.
Exactly.
Is it a physical visitation as well, or is it strictly in its consciousness?
No, I think that both things go on. I think we're dealing with the intelligent inhabitants of other dimensions, who perhaps have this is where I would go if you ask me what I think this phenomenon is about. I think it's an interdimensional phenomenon, and I think there's a physical element to that. It may well be that the inhabitants of other dimensions have found ways to physically penetrate different dimensions, of which ours might be one. Perhaps that's what the flying saucer is. Perhaps it's a device to break through the veil between worlds, rather than a device to carry us across interstellar space.
Right.
See, this is where I find the UFO, where I find myself at odds with the UFO lobby, because although the UFO lobby is demanding disclosure from government,
yes,
most of the UFO lobby is very much as state-specific as government is. That they want to see this problem purely in nuts and bolts physical terms. That we see these flying objects in the sky, we are abducted by these beings in one way or another, and that therefore this must be beings from distant parts of this physical universe.
Right.
There is no reason why that should be the case. We have a phenomenon here.
It's easier to comprehend, I think. Right?
It seems
Isn't
to be
it?
Easier to comprehend, but the evidence to me suggests that the problem is more complicated than that, and that we may be dealing with other inhabitants from this physical universe, but it's more likely that at least we're also dealing with inhabitants of other dimensions, and that this is why they become the phenomenon is so hard to pin down in mainstream scientific terms. Because mainstream science is state-specific, and we need to alter our state of consciousness in order to properly explore these experiences. And this is why, in Supernatural, I devote quite a lot of the book, a few chapters, to exploring the work of Dr. Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico, and the extraordinary experiences that his volunteers had under the influence of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, the first federally approved program to give DMT to human volunteers, was undertaken by Rick Strassman in the 1990s. And the information that came out of that study was so mind-blowingly extraordinary and cast such a new and different light on the alien abduction phenomenon that I don't think anybody who claims to be interested in UFOs and alien abductions should ignore it. They have to take it into account. It should be regarded, this area of exploration should be regarded as an additional weapon in our armory for exploring the UFO mystery.
It is fascinating, Graham, how so many experts in the field of ufology begin to change from believing that they were exclusively physical to more dimensional, like you're beginning to say. Let's talk about that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.